All right. Well, good morning, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome again. Welcome to Quality Talks. Thank you very much for joining us today. Today, we're going to ask a panel of industry leaders in the quality management discipline the following question. Is quality management as a discipline losing its strategic role within manufacturing? The format of the meeting will be a free-form discussion, which I'll moderate, so our panel members can share their thoughts and rich experiences on this topic. I'll start with a brief introduction of my guests and then we'll dive right in. And if you as a viewer would like to ask any questions, please just submit them through the webinar platform. They'll be collected and passed on to me, and I'll either try to answer them during the discussion if the timing is right, or else I'll definitely try and get to them at the end of the session. All right, so our panel today consists of two quality management leaders, John Blankensop and Gerben Dehaan. John Blankensop has a wealth of experience in quality management, having been in the field now for over 40 years. John's held a variety of roles from hands-on to senior leadership positions focusing on strategy and policy. John's a senior member of the American Society for Quality and an ASQ certified manager of quality and organizational excellence. He's also a certified quality engineer and a certified quality auditor. He's also an authenticated third-party aerospace QMS certification lead auditor. John also has a quality management related channel on YouTube called Big Q University, and I highly recommend that everyone check that out. Our other guest is Gerben Dehaan. Gerben is CPO and co-founder of AliceQI, a leading cloud-based no-code quality management platform for manufacturing. Gerben leads AliceQI's product development teams to use the voice of the market to guide product innovation and roadmap direction of the AliceQI's platform. Gerben has over 20 years of experience in the intersection of technology and quality management. Welcome, Gerben. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so to start our quality talk, let's set the stage. The quality management profession started in the early 20th century with giants like Schuert, Deming, and Juran. The discipline advanced significantly in post-World War II manufacturing boom led by Japan. Arguably, the discipline's last major innovation, total quality management, TQM, occurred over 40 years ago in the 1980s. So today, many quality professionals feel that the quality management has been on a long, slow decline, or at least stagnation, since the 80s. And the discipline is no longer seen as a strategic priority by business leadership, resulting in suboptimal business results across the manufacturing industry. So that's the sort of the challenging question that we'll be discussing. And I'll lead in the conversation by going to you, John. Do you feel that quality management has lost its purchase within manufacturing as a strategic area of focus?
Thank you, Niels. Yes, I do. You know, being in the field now for over 40 years, I was, I entered into the field in the 80s. I remember what it was like back in those days. And I do feel that over time, there has been a decline in the relevancy of quality as a strategic area of focus. I think we see this playing out on the news today with some major manufacturers losing sight of quality and paying some severe consequences for it. So, yeah, I do believe, you know, we kind of, it feels to me like we're at a crossroads. We're at a point where we really need to think about what we can do about this. I think it is an issue for sure.
Yeah, thanks. Well, maybe share some other, if you would, sort of observations or experiences from your own personal, you know, professional life, of how that decline manifests itself. Like, what are the symptoms that you are seeing within your, you know, purview that that cause you to have this belief?
Yeah, so what I've witnessed over the years, let's say over the last 7 years, I've worked with many, many organizations, either auditing, consulting, or training. And the first thing that's very apparent to me is I see a lack of leadership involvement in quality. I also see a lack of business leadership demonstrating quality by leading quality by example, being on the front lines of quality. I think they, you know, leadership has become more hands off over the years when it comes to managing quality. I think the other area is that I don't see organizations looking at quality as a central business issue. And managing that strategically. And it's really easy to determine that. And, you know, the folks that are participating in the webinar could ask themselves, does my organization really understand the organizational strengths and opportunities relative to quality that we could leverage to improve quality? And do we truly understand our internal weaknesses and external threats that represent risks to delivering quality? And are we proactively managing that? Because what winds up happening is if we don't proactively manage quality as a central business issue, eventually unintended quality results will wind up managing the organization. And that's what we see. People, they get the epiphany that, wow, this thing called quality management is important, but it's usually after we have a major incident or event. And so those are kind of the things that I'm seeing that really are indicators that we aren't focusing on quality as a relevant strategic area in organizations.
Great. Kerman, I'll ask you the same question. Do you agree that quality management is in a decline, and what do you see?
Yeah, well, of course, I don't have the experience that John has, at least not the length of it. But we see the symptoms absolutely. So we talk to quality professionals every day, and we see them struggling with selling their improvement projects internally and getting this leadership support. So I think that's a clear symptom that leadership doesn't value quality as they should. And as a consequence, we see people burning out because of that. So if quality is the sole responsibility of the quality team, then everything and if quality is only talked about if things go wrong, then you're overloading your quality team with negativism, and they are paying quite a high price for that. So these are symptoms of the lack of leadership support, I think, and that's clear, and that's something that should obviously change for the sake of the poor people dealing with all this this shit, if you want, but also for the value of the business and for the continuity and both the long term and the short term result, I think, because it's clear that all the John referred to some of the major cases that make the news, but that's only 1%, even much less even, of all the quality issues that actually happen, of course. So every company can benefit short term of an improved quality operation. So it's clear, and I think, speaking for myself and John, we're on a mission.
Great.
Absolutely.
All right, well, so before we talk about solutions and what the community of practice can do to change this this reality, let's talk a little bit more about, or talk first about, root causes. So why do we think this has happened? Because I think we all know about, and John, you probably remember, the glory days of quality management, where quality management was a strategic focus area for many organizations. And So, you know, that's changed. And it, before we talk about solutions, it would be good to try and get on the same page together about why that happened. So share some ideas and some thoughts of why, what's behind this this negative trend.
Yeah, sure. You know, I'll give you a perspective, not only from living through the 80s, but I was very fortunate to work for Harley-Davidson Motor Company from 1996 to 2005. And what I can tell you from that experience is that you need to have a laser cultural mindset on quality. And you need to understand quality in a very different perspective, what Duran would call the big Q quality perspective. And so from a root cause perspective, I really think there is still, with across industries and across the globe, there isn't this unified effort to elevate the mindset of what quality management really is. Now, Harley-Davidson learned it the hard way. If you know the Harley-Davidson story, they almost lost the brand when it was owned by AMF. They lost their handle on quality, and it almost destroyed them. And the resurrection of that organization, you know, really a cornerstone of that was the mindset around quality. Quality was a priority and a central business issue. And I think that was big. The other thing I fear, Nils, is that I think within the community of practice of quality management, we might be suffering a little bit from an identity crisis. And what I mean by that is we're promoting big Q quality, where we're trying to talk about quality as being integrated across an organization. But we have to understand what our in the profession, what our new roles and responsibilities will be in that kind of a culture. We have to shift from thinking about quality as a department to thinking about quality as a discipline, and that discipline is integrated everywhere in the organization. That can be a hard thing to do for quality management leaders as well. So I think that's another piece of the root cause is we in the community of practice, we've got to think about our roles, responsibilities, and authority in a different kind of mindset, in this big Q quality mindset.
Great, thanks. So Gerben, coming at it from a technology perspective, but also just from your interactions as a technology expert with, you know, business professionals, quality professionals, what kind of root causes do you see driving this trend?
Yeah, well, I think so root causes for lack of leadership support can be found, I think, also in globalization and a race to the bottom when it comes to margins. So the, well, compared to the situation in the 60s or the 70s when the quality, the founding fathers of quality made their great work, I think the world has significantly changed, of course. So there's much more competition from across the globe, from countries with a completely different labor wage or price level. So the competition is significantly different. And that, of course, has an impact on the margins and the investments that you can do in quality. So I think that's a race to the bottom to for some industries where margins are very thin, and that comes at a price. So you need to be completely as lean as possible, and of course lean is a quality concept, but that's often forgotten, and they only look at the at a lean profit and loss sheet if you want. So I think one of the root causes can definitely be found there, and then I think the so coming at it from a technology perspective, and it's not necessarily a root cause, but maybe a consequence is that the lack of of digitization, or the degree of digitization is lower than you would expect in manufacturing. It feels like other industries are progressing much more rapidly in digitization and benefiting from new technology than manufacturing does, at least in the quality space. But that's more of a solution gap than a root cause. But there's definitely a lot of room for improvement on that end. But we'll probably touch upon that when we discuss solutions.
Right. Perfect. So I want to sort of explore this just a little bit more before we go on to solutions and kind of stay with root causes a bit longer. If, you know, business leadership and quality management professionals, quality leadership are, when they work cooperatively together and are pulling in the same direction, it's, it should be a yin and a yang situation where they're mutually beneficial and in lockstep with each other. But for the sake of the discussion, what I'd like to do is sort of separate them and look at, leadership, let's sort of take the root causes on ourselves as the first, and ask ourselves the question or pose the position that if business leadership is relegating quality management more to a subordinate position, right, off to the side, maybe it's because we're not serving our internal customer the way they want to be served. Now, I know that's a challenging question, right? That presupposes that, we're doing something wrong and business leadership is doing the right thing. But for the sake of discussion, I think that's interesting. So let's look at it that way. If we were to say that we need to innovate or change the way we're doing things to better support this new business reality, Gerben, that you're speaking about, right? This globalized, highly competitive world. What are some opportunities that we have within the field to maybe change our approach? And I'll start with you, John, on that one. How would you innovate our field to more accurately align with expectations of business leadership in this new world?
That's a great question. From my perspective, the big role that quality management can play within an organization is to help drive the organization towards being managers of systemic causes of results versus just managers of results. So if you're working in a quality organizational culture where it seems that quality gets exercised or energized when we have a quality issue, but there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of activity around the efforts to prevent quality issues to begin with, I think that's an area that quality management as a profession could really try to help work with businesses to understand. And the fact is that we as a profession, we as a discipline, really have three strong elements of quality management: quality planning, quality control, and quality improvement. And if we can provide those support functions, those services to the organization, I think that we can, present ourselves as being a value and an impact to the organization instead of just simply mopping up after right. There's been a quality mess and, trying right. to get our feet back on the ground.
And you believe, John, that in doing so, that will create or that will provide a quality function or a quality service internally that is able to meet the new needs of this globalized, hyper-competitive world?
I think it definitely would. And Gerben, it would be interesting to hear your view on this, because it reminds me, it takes me to the cost of quality model, right? Yeah. If I can shift and be more preventive and more proactive than being on the reactive side, I can show a business case and a return on investment to the organization.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So if you look at it from the perspective of what should the quality team do in order to change the organization for the better, then I think it starts with internal education. So indeed, show how quality contributes to the business results. And then, of course, we talk a lot about the total cost of quality, but I think we should ask ourselves the more fundamental or philosophical question, maybe even if the prevention should be considered a cost or an investment. Of course, it costs money, but it's an investment into the in your people, in the business in general. And well, companies invest tons in all kinds of consultants to help improve processes. Well, why not invest in preventative quality measures? So I think it starts with this internal education. And of course, money talks. So that brings us to the cost of quality. So if you can quantify the impact of quality or the lack of it, then you'll probably find an audience that listens to you and helps you to understands what the impact is, and that will help you realize your objective and get to a ultimately get to a better culture of quality.
That's very interesting. And of course, costs is a very important dimension, maybe the ultimate dimension to consider within a business. But of course, there's also time, things like time to market, which based on our, what we're all reading in the newspaper and our own experiences, the world is accelerating. Time to market is becoming more of a competitive differentiator than it was in the 80s. So I think it would be fair to say that at least some business leadership experiences quality to be, add friction, right, to the operation rather than help it be agile and help it be nimble in the marketplace. What would you say to that, John?
Well, what first comes to my mind when it comes to the proactive and preventive approach to quality is sometimes you have to slow down to go faster. I can actually get to market faster if I slow down in the development and design of products and processes using advanced quality planning tools to get it right the first time and launch it seamlessly versus some launches that I've seen that have been launched at maybe 75 or 80%. They're disasters and they actually create delay in costs. So the cost of quality model can bear this out. I might add time, I might add cost. As Gerben says, this is an investment. I'm slowing down a little bit, but I wind up getting to market faster. So that's what comes to my mind when I think about that.
Right. Right. Perfect. All right. So let's talk more about concrete solutions and what we all can do to restore quality management's position, rightful position in the business place. So, what role do we play around advocacy and education within quality management? John, I'll start with you.
Well, the first role that we play is what our participants are doing right now. So I commend everyone that is on this webinar. We have to arm ourselves with knowledge. We have to expand our mindsets relative to quality. Getting involved in webinars, seeking new knowledge is fantastic. I think we have to be abreast of the current context of quality management in industries and in the world. And I would challenge everyone participating Similarly to what I did at the my presentation at the World Conference on Quality and Improvement, and that is get connected with ASQ Excellence, the American Society for Quality Excellence Group. They publish every year a series of reports that they call Insights on Excellence. One of those reports is their Executive Summary and Annual Review. So the 2023 report is out. It's a fantastic report. It has a lot of good information relative to quality and organizational excellence. I think we have to get our heads wrapped around what the current state is so that we can help position ourselves. I think we have to go back to the basics. We have to understand the basics of Big Q quality management. We have to be advocates of Big Q quality management. We really have to understand that. And then the other thing I would say is we have to stick together as a community of practice. We have to pull together tighter. One of the ways we can do that is aggressively engage in mentoring relationships. I think we need to do more of this, right? So if there's people out there that are participating that have been in the quality field for over 20 years, grab some mentees. And teach and train. I have several mentees right now that I'm working with that have less than 10 years of experience. And I'm helping them, you know, understand the fundamental concepts of Big Q quality management. For those on the webinar that have been in the field for maybe 10 years or less, seek a mentor and use that opportunity to grow your knowledge in advocacy for Big Q quality. So I think those are the two things that come to my mind. I would say this, in the field of quality management, there's no such thing as an expert. We're all students. We all have to be in the mindset of being a student, right? We can't afford to think of ourselves as experts. Einstein said, an expert was somebody who's made every mistake possible in a narrow field of study, right? That's not who we are, right? We're students of this discipline, and we have to constantly approach it like that so we're open to learning on a daily basis.
That's great. All right, so we've had some questions come in from attendees, so I want to go through those with you before we return to our thread about what we as quality management professionals can do to restore our position in the field. So one question that came in from Brian, and I'll ask this question to you, Gerben, is because I think it relates to, in a way, to the cost of quality framework and creating an ROI around quality initiatives. The question is, one area I have an issue with is proving the negative. So how do you put a price on what did not happen because of our quality efforts? How do you relate that to quality efforts versus other efforts?
Mm-hmm. So that's the, if I understand this correctly, it's the potential that quality, so the failures that quality prevented and quantifying them to showcase the value of quality, right?
I think that's right. It's like if you do your job right, nothing bad happens, right?
So no, exactly. And then you only see the price tag of it, but not the benefit. Right. That doesn't surface, yes. Well, yeah. I think in many organizations you have some historical records of deviations that you had before you implemented these preventative measures, and that probably provides you with the answer. But then, of course, there could be a situation where you actually do too much or too many inspections, and you don't see any. If you test 100% of your products and everything is good, then you should criticize your inspection frequency and your sampling frequency and try to reduce that. So that's not really quantifying the negative, but it's optimizing where you spent your money. I'm not entirely sure if that's a feasible solution for Brian in this case. Of course, it depends on the requirements for the customer. But I think in general, Well, first of all, I think we should applaud Brian for his case. If he seeks proof that his investments pay off, then he is in a much better place than many of his peers. So that's a job well done. And I think, well, quantifying it, you could look at, well, either your historical records or at industry benchmarks. If you show that you perform, that you outperform the vast majority of the industry, then you can quantify the cost of poor quality at your peers, and that's probably a good estimation of what you would have been facing without these precautionary measures. So I think that's the direction I would seek to quantify the value of the current operation.
Right. You need to relate your investment to something that could either be the previous situation before the investment or some external benchmark, right? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Brian, we hope that answered your question. If not, follow up with more. So another question was, and this relates to our conversation a little earlier about cost and agility or time to market being, you know, key dimensions to focus our quality initiatives on. So this question is from Bjorn. What are examples of advanced quality planning tools that support both speed and quality? And John, we'll give that one to you.
Yeah, so I would turn to what we've learned from the automotive industry and what they call advanced product quality planning, or APQP. And APQP is broken out into five phases. Phase one is the planning phase, which is an important phase of identifying the requirements for quality and the objectives for quality. Phase two then goes into product and process design and development. And then product and service design and development, and then concurrently bringing in process design and development. So some of the big tools that you'll see used is design failure modes and effects analyses, and the corresponding process failure modes and effects analyses that understands the key and critical characteristics of quality in a product and in a process, understanding where there are potential risks of creating quality issues, and then coming up with ways to mitigate those risks. And you can mitigate those risks through redesign of the product or redesign of the process or implementing control measures. So these are tools that can be used. There's also, of course, tools that can be used to measure process variation and process capability using statistical process control tools. Another suite of tools that are used is in the area of measurement systems analysis, or MSA, where you are using measuring devices to help monitor and measure your process and your product, and making sure that you're not introducing unwanted variability into the process through your measuring devices. So I would recommend searching out the AIAG Automotive Industry Action Group APQP methodology. In fact, they are just releasing, I think, their third edition of that. And from there, you can learn about some of those tools. And I believe those tools can be applied in any industry. I don't think it's specific to just automotive. I'm in the aerospace industry, and the aerospace industry has just incorporated APQP as AS9145. So we are now using it since 2016 in the aerospace industry. So I think those are some examples of tools and a reference where you could learn more about them.
Great, thanks. And yep. Gerben, do you, from a technology perspective, do you see any opportunities?
Oh yeah. So, well, first of all, this FMEA, so the failure mode analysis, is something that we apply in software as well. I think it's a universal tool. You can assess. You can use it for any product, any service. Just think about, okay, what can go wrong? What would be the effect? Do I need to fix this? Do I need to, what are my my checks and balances in the process? So this can be applied in any product, any industry, any surface. So absolutely. I think looking at it from a vendor or a tech perspective, I think, of course, we have a lot of experience with the quality of our own software operation and software quality in general. And looking at from that perspective, and I know software has this unfair advantage that we can control both the pre-delivery and the post-delivery quality because we can fix things. Well, if I look at our operation, we ship updates basically every day. And if there's a need and we can patch things within a few minutes, well, of course, that's an unfair advantage. You don't have that in other industries. But I think quality people can be inspired by other industries. And it might not be a lesson that you can apply one-on-one in your case, but you can at least take the, be inspired and take some bits of it. And I think what you see in software, if I take that industry as an example, is continuous monitoring. There's probing in performance probing, determining the load of an application and determining when things break, etc., which provides you with a lot of data and insight that you can feed back into your design process and know when things are going to be tricky and performance is at stake. So that's something also what they call in software land the DevOps discipline. So that's integration of development and operation, where you have a multidisciplinary team and multidisciplinary roles that monitor operation and feedback into development. So design and product development continuously. So that's, I think, if you look at automotive, then the what they really spearheaded was this integration of design and quality, or basically the other way around, feedback, the continuous feedback of post delivery quality back into design, and well, with great successes, because I think automotive is well known for its for the reliability of its product. So this DevOps role where you combine post-delivery quality with design quality, I think, is something that might be applicable to many roles. In software, you also see new roles emerging like software reliability engineers. So with these are dedicated roles with just one responsibility: look at reliability and stabilize, standardize as much as possible to get out all of the variation out of it. And of course, you have similar roles with quality engineers in manufacturing. So it might be more of a instantiation of these practices in software, but I think still it's very relevant for people to look at different industries, learn what they do there, and be inspired. And I think to rephrase what John said, go out and expose yourself to the world, learn from others. See what you can steal from them, basically.
Mm-hmm. Great, absolutely. Thank you. All right, I have a comment/question here from Nikki, and I'm going to read it to you verbatim. I don't have the same scope and years of experience John has. I have about 12 years, and what I've seen from when I started until now is a shift. The shift is that we're moving from, we want a product that both we, the manufacturer, and our customer considers good quality based on expectations and requirements. We're shifting from that to, we want a product that our customer accepts. And acceptance levels can be very subjective, and this introduces a level of chance instead of certainty that your customer gets a quality product. One of the results is that supportive departments like customer service and rework grow in staff numbers to address the issues, not a good development. And the question is, do John and Gerben also recognize this? And I'll ask, start with John.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And you know, when you think about the basic definition of quality, it's the degree to which inherent characteristics of an object fulfills requirements. That's the base definition of quality. And if you can't iron down the expectations and nail down the expectations of what the requirements are, and these requirements become a bit nebulous and they're not enforced in the process side of things and on the acceptance side of things from the customer, then you start getting into a tough situation, what sometimes I call the tail wagging the dog situation. And now you're chasing, you're constantly chasing what the customer is perceiving as being acceptable to them. And boy, did we face that at Harley-Davidson, right? So a big piece of quality of our motorcycles was the cosmetic appearance of the motorcycle. And if you could imagine, how do you create a set of requirements on cosmetic acceptability and be able to produce that in the process, enforce that through the control mechanisms, and then deal with that when the customer says, I don't like the way that paint looks, or I don't like the way that chrome looks. And you say, well, it meets our requirements. And they're like, sorry, I'm not happy, right? So you're chasing, you're constantly trying to find that spot. And it's a challenge. It is a huge challenge. The way we dealt with it is by hyper engaging with our customers and trying to stay ahead of what the emerging kind of trends were relative to the acceptability of the quality of our product. So we would set up motorcycles that had known defects in the cosmetics of the bike. And at rallies, we would present these bikes to owners and say, what do you think about the way this looks? And they'd never see the things that we had, but they would find things that we didn't find, that we didn't intend for them to find. So we were constantly trying to calibrate ourselves based on their perspective. But once you gain that perspective, you somehow have to formalize that perspective. So it is the challenging part of quality. But for me, it's always been trying to stay current on what their expectations are and get them formalized into the requirements. Because one of the first rules of quality is good parts look like the drawing, bad parts don't. You know, that if you can't create a reference to understand acceptability versus, you know, nonconformance, it's very difficult in the field. So I think that like answers the question, but it at least acknowledges the challenge for sure.
I think it's really exciting to see what brands like Nike do in the realm of mass customization. So they have standardized customization basically. And of course, that's not there are some degrees of freedom. So if you look at these sneakers, you can define the colors and the patterns and things like that. And you can completely tune that to your needs with some web application and things like that. And that is all well controlled. So they define these degrees of freedom. They completely design their processes to incorporate these degrees of freedom, well controlled, well managed. And then if you do that right, then you have a tremendous amount of degrees of freedom because it's all the various permutations that you can get. It ends up being almost indefinite number of different sneakers you can generate with it. But basically, it's all derived from a single process with a few or quite a few variables and parameters in there. So I think the answer is to always, at least as a manufacturer of standard products, always stay in control of your products and your processes. So of course, customer demands are subject to constant change, and you need to adapt in order to stay in business. I think that's probably the most important characteristic of a company, be able to adapt to the ever-changing needs, but then still stay in control and be able to standardize and to well, to manage your processes. And I think this trend of mass customization, I think that's where technology helps in or helps as well. Mass customization can be an answer there. Standardize the variations, manage them, and then you're able to deliver quality with all these degrees of freedom.
Yeah, great. Interesting. All right, so I have one more question, and then we'll pick up our thread on what quality management community practice can do to change our destiny. This question comes from Christopher, and again, I'll read it. Where do you see the quality mindset starting, i.e. early days in schools with younger students? It happens in Japan, Germany, Switzerland. It used to happen here in the U.S., but seems to be gone and or very rare. How do we bring it back? And is that even possible? Our educational system seems to disregard the trades and manufacturing education at an early age. And in particular, I guess, quality management. So, John, do you want to comment first on that?
I love, Christopher, I love that question. I think it starts at a very early age. And, you know, my daughters were cursed with having a father in the quality management profession because I basically used the plan, do, check, act methodology on them in school from elementary school level when it came to academic performance, planning and then executing and then assessing actual performance to targets and then coming up with action plans when there were gaps. And I do think it starts, you know, this idea of quality management in my mind can apply to life as well as it can to, you know, manufacturing or to business. So I think it can start very early. You know, ASQ had a program where they were incorporating quality tools and techniques into the classroom. You know, it'd be interesting to see where that's at and if it's, we can resurrect that, because I think we need to do that. I think we have to instill the idea of quality management as early as middle school, as kids are starting to understand what they would like to do for their profession or their vocation. I think we should integrate it into vocational education, into the trades. And I think we should integrate it into high school learning as well. And then when we advance into the college realm, I think we've got to integrate it into some of the business programs that are going on out there. So a lot of people that are getting their business degrees, I think, should understand the key element of quality management as being a business leader. So yeah, I think it should be integrated throughout our educational experience.
Yeah, thank you. Anything, any link to mentoring here, John? I know you're big on mentoring, and you mentioned it earlier as well. I mean, that's possibly something that we as a practice, community practice, can do as well, as to sort of, you know, reignite the passion and take some responsibility for spreading the word.
I think absolutely. I see it as really critical. You know, I didn't get to where I got without having some key mentors that showed me the ropes along the way. And I think mentoring folks as early as possible in their development, career development, educational development, can be critical. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I can't emphasize that enough, to be involved, be a mentor. Or if you're young and just aspiring in the profession, find a mentor. You probably won't find them in your organization, or if you're lucky, you might, but reach out into the community of practice. ASQ is a great, great professional organization to reach out and connect with a mentor or a mentee.
Gerben, do you... You know, kind of staying on this theme, do you see any change, generational change, happening amongst quality professionals?
I think we see a shift. So with the newer generation, Gen Z, if you want, or however you might want to label it, but people are valuing life differently than even my generation. I'm from the early 80s, but I think so. Life is less about possession and money, for that matter. It's more about purpose and spending your time well, wisely, and then where it actually matters. And I think that's something that the generation that's coming off out of university right now is really bringing to the to organizations. And I think that's a great thing, because they don't want to waste any time on working on crappy products. They want to do something more purposeful with their lives and their careers. So they drive sustainability, they drive efficiency in the organizations, I think. And well, of course, they still need to learn a lot, and they don't have the power in the organization yet, but they do inspire the rest of the organization and drive change. So I think that can only be beneficial for all of us, of course. And so I think that's a thing. And then looking at my generation and people that now start to become to land into more managerial roles, they don't accept inefficient paper-based processes like the older generations, with all due respect, John. But so we see a lot of new quality managers that experience an organization driven by paper, and the first thing they start doing is to look for digital solutions to improve their operations. So definitely the younger generations are changing organizations for the better.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Good points. Sort of linking to the culture of quality, right, and the benefits of having a culture of quality.
Yep.
In creating a sense of organizational pride, increasing retention.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at it we talked a lot about culture of quality in previous talks, and what really is instrumental in changing a culture of quality is the awareness, ownership, involvement, as we typically say. So things like accessibility of information drives awareness. If you have big screens all across the organization that show charts that represent the quality performance, then you're faced with quality or the lack of it every time that you look at these screens. So this really drives awareness and helps to change this culture. So yeah, absolutely, there's a big connection with the cultural dimension.
Yeah, excellent. Well, we're coming up towards the end of our talk. Time has flown. Great conversation. We have about 5 minutes left, so I'd like to wind down maybe and pick up one more question and give you each an opportunity to chime in. I'll just start with the very broad open question. How would we facilitate the cultivation of this big Q mindset within an organization? So if we want to impact our standing in the field, we need to change minds and hearts, and how, you know, we need to be in charge of our destiny. It's our job to change these minds and hearts. It won't happen by itself. So how do we do that, John?
I really like the fact, Niels, that you use the word cultivation, because the first thing I think we have to do is think about a cultural mindset, or the idea of culture, as a verb. It's action. This is something that we have to actualize. And so I talk about the three phases of a quality culture. Phase one being aspiration, where we create identity around quality. Phase two is acuity, where we create unity of purpose and direction around quality. And then phase three is actualization, where we manifest the systems and the processes and the resources that achieve the quality objectives and that aspiration for quality that we've planned. And I always go back to a saying that Peter Drucker had, and that was, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And so if you don't have the actualized culture that you are aspiring to achieve, all the strategies that you put in place are for naught, because the culture that you're actualizing is not aligned with that aspiration. So where I see organizations go wrong is that disengagement between what's actually happening culturally and what we're aspiring to do culturally. And I think quality management as a community of practice has got to facilitate these three phases of moving from aspiration through acuity through actualization. And the proof in the pudding of any culture is results. And I talk about an NFL American football team, right, that wants to say, we have a culture of winning here. Well, okay, show me your culture of winning through your record. Are you a winning organization? Okay, you have a culture of winning. If you haven't won a game, I'm not so sure you have a culture of winning. I think you're aspiring, but you haven't actualized it yet. So that, to me, is the big rallying call for quality management, is we have to facilitate the actualization of the culture aligned with the aspiration of the culture.
Yeah, great. So that's a nice segue to Gerben, I think. I know, Gerben, you in the past have talked about ways that technology can support this cultural shift. You had your own three A's that, if I'm not mistaken, that, but so maybe chime in. How do you see our responsibility, and what can we do maybe using technology to change this mindset?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, first of all, it is indeed our responsibility as quality professionals to pick up the baton and try to change things. Don't be passive, but actively try to change things. I think that's first and foremost. But then, indeed, looking at how to change things, well, it's not three A's. It's awareness, involvement, and ownership. But still, it's the holy triumvirate of quality or culture of quality. So yes, indeed, awareness. So make people exposed to quality and their performance. So again, if you talk about this culture of winning, well, show the numbers, because ultimately you want to have performance indicators that show that you're on the right track. And if you don't have the access to this information, then you're not aware, and you're not motivated or at least not inspired by these numbers. And then involvement, ownership. I think everyone should be aware of their role and their impact of their role on quality. Ultimately, everyone has an impact, how small or large that might be, but everyone has an impact on quality and the culture of quality. And if you consider quality something isolated within the quality team, then the rest of the organization feels disconnected, or you encourage them basically to be disconnected. So it should be the other way around. Everyone should be aware of their role. And think about it. If you really want to make this practical, think about a short kind of a workshop where you ask everyone in the organization, okay, tell me how you can affect quality. And what really works well for that is more of a playful form is the negative brainstorm. So think about, how can you screw up quality? And then if you invert that at the end, you have the positive impact. But it might be a nice playful exercise during a company get together or a town hall or something like that, to think about the negative brainstorm. And okay, let's spend a minute thinking how we can screw this company up. How can we get the quality down the drain? And of course, it might be a tricky one, but I think you'll be surprised with the answers. And then inverting them gives you a lot of ideas, I think, for good measures to take.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. Well, John and Gerben, thank you both. It's been a wonderful conversation, lots of really good insights. I hope everybody in the audience, attendees, appreciated it as well. Please know that we plan to hold more of these quality talks. We'll bounce around between various topics, talk about culture, talk about actions that we can take to improve quality or the culture of quality. We'll talk about technology, a bunch of different things. So please, if you thought this was of value, stay tuned. If you have any questions for the panel members, either or both of them, please feel free to submit them through email or follow up. We'd love to follow up with you, and we'd be happy to get you answers or engage in some other way that's useful to you. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, John and Gerben, for your time. And until next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.